Psalm 60. Well, introduction, the city wall has been breached. And again, you can read that at a lot of levels, but let's take it simply for a start. The invading army is causing the earth to tremble as in an earthquake. And I read you the following from Joel, which picks up some of the mood of this psalm. They leap upon the city, they run upon the walls, they climb up into the houses, they enter through the windows like a thief. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon are darkened, and the stars withdraw their shining. Does it remind you of the apocalypse, any of that stuff? And then people read the apocalypse, and there's a lunar eclipse, and they tell you the last days are coming, so become a Jehovah's Witnesses, or whatever they have in mind for you to become. You know, like we do this, we're amazingly silly people on the whole. Well, you're not, but I can be, and I know people who are. Like, we're very vulnerable, aren't we? And I think it's why we need to teach. They do it in Germany. Why don't we do it here? We need to teach philosophy in our schools. We've got to stop thinking the schools are a place where we get people ready for the marketplace. They're too beautiful for that. A school has to be a place where we develop a person who's able to think and be free. And I'm quite sure if you get to the end of your, well, if you get the end of your higher school certificate and you haven't done economics at school, but you're bright and you're intelligent and you know where to research and you've thought, you would, in any case, I know from my years at the university, they took no notice of the economics you did at school when you arrived. They started right again. Some of you may have done it, and because everything's changed since you're in. So it's teaching the mind to think and become a free, wonderful community. That's what we've got to do with education. And you pick it up like me. You pick up anything. We're all capable of 50, 60 things that we could do really quickly. I know you have to do basic literature and mathematics, you're not, and physics. But there has to be much more accent on languages, on history, because you can't think without history, on philosophy. What do you mean when you say that? When you read the newspaper, it says that. What are the assumptions behind it? What are they actually saying in there? And I know this is done at schools, but we've got to do more and more of it to get people ready to be free. So the tension between God's remembered promise and the actual situation expressed in a lament, that's what this is, this psalm, is resolved in the final verse with an act of trust. Well, they must have liked this psalm more than normal because verses 5 to 12 is repeated in Psalm 108, verses 6 to 13, word for word. Or Psalm 108, verses 6 to 13 is repeated in Psalm 60, verses 5 to 12. Which came first, I'm not in a position to be sure, and probably no one knows. Okay. Let's go to the Psalm 60. O God, you've rejected us. Look at the you. You've rejected us. Well, of course, if the walls are breached, you did it. Do you get me? Because you're controlling everything. You crucified Jesus. We thought that for a while. There's whole theology books written, why did God will Jesus to be crucified? You must have read it. Well, it has to be balmy. But still, it's there. So it doesn't take long for this to creep back, that God is somehow behind everything. And philosophically, you look at that and it starts to make a bit of sense till you really look, you know. And it denies free will and it denies sin. Because if everything that happens is God's will, then everything that happens is God's will, that means there's no sin. Is that logical enough? So you have rejected us. You have breached our walls. Well, heavens, that was the Assyrian army, for God's sake, anyhow. You've become angry. Come back to us. God probably said, look, I haven't left. You've caused the land to quake. You've torn it open. Repair its cracks, for it's tottering like the wall. You've made your people suffer a disaster. You've given us wine to drink that's made us reel. Just read for you from Isaiah chapter 51, just very similar language. Of course, You'd expect the language to be similar. They're drawing on each other. This is their education, the Bible. They don't have any other writings. Rouse yourself, rouse yourself. Stand up, O Jerusalem. Look at the difference. The psalmist is asking God to rouse himself. Isaiah is saying to Jerusalem, how about you waking up? Rouse yourself, rouse yourself. Stand up, Jerusalem. You have drunk at the hand of Yahweh the cup of his wrath, who has drunk to the dregs the bowl that has caused you to stagger. See, I've taken the cup from your hand. You shall drink no more of the bowl of my wrath. This is written in 2 Isaiah. Cyrus of Persia, they know about this from the rumors that are coming in the herald announcing it in the city of Babylon. This Persian Cyrus has taken a couple of big battles, not many more, all through Turkey, we'll call it Turkey, Syria, going through that area, and he's liberating people. He's letting them go back to their own country. He's not into keeping people subdued. He's into tax and all that, but a lot of them want to be there. They feel liberated. So they're looking forward to the, when he gets to Babylon, he's going to liberate us from Babylon too. And he's let all those people go back. He let us go back. So that's the second book of Isaiah, looking forward to the going back, and the level hills will be made, the mountains will be made level, and the valleys will be filled, and you know all that John the Baptist stuff. Preparing a way for the Lord. Well, this whole book is saying it's all over. So, you know, we're going to go home. We're sure of it. So get ready. Now back, leaving Isaiah, back to our psalm, verse 4. You've set up a standard for those who fear you, that they may rally to it out of bowshot. Now this is before the longbow was invented, of course. But the ordinary bows, you know, and in the battle, you've seen it on television, I'm sure, different battles in the ancient world, etc. So they're losing, and then they hear, and they see the standard over the king, Judah's standard, so they all rally, and the horses, if they've got any, gather around there for a regrouping in view of defence and then attack. All that stuff's all behind this psalm. Real life experience. Verse 5, give victory with your right hand, so that those whom you love may be rescued. It assumes love, which is lovely. God loves us. It never dawned on them. I shouldn't say never. There's one little verse in Isaiah that reaches towards it, and there's one other, I can't remember where it is, in one of the Psalms, that God says, look, I love the Ethiopians. I love the Assyrians. Babylon is mine. I don't know how the bloke got away with that. You know, they could have just hung, drawn and quartered him. But anyhow, they didn't. The psalm survived, but it's very rare that you find anything in the Old Testament that would give you the slightest idea that God would love our enemies. They can't think like we're God's people. They're our enemies. So they're God's enemies. Ergo, QED, finished. And that's what they think. And it took Jesus to embrace the Samaritan talk about this and to shock people, and they crucified him for it. So it wasn't popular talk, even Jesus' day. But that's what Christianity's about. Can you believe it? And then you look at the Crusades, and they weren't all bad, by the way, the Crusades, but there was an element in them. And then you look at burning witches, because, well, after all, they're women, and they were saying spiritual things, and they should have been back in the home anyhow, so that's enough to burn them. And maybe the husbands didn't mind, I don't know. But you got all this, you know, but this is all done in the name of Christianity. So do you see how culture domesticates, and ours does too, mine does too, we're all doing it, so we just better be careful. But sometimes it's blatantly obvious. Well, I think it's blatantly obvious in one of the leading power of the Western world at the moment, which invokes Jesus and Christianity for shocking behaviour. So it's alive and well, this stuff. The one whom you love may be rescued. Answer us, plea. Deuteronomy reads, of Benjamin he said, Benjamin in Hebrew, Benjamin. Yamin is the right hand. So Benjamin is the son of my right hand. And the directions in Hebrew are all said with your back to the Mediterranean, facing the east. So Benjamin is the furthest tribe on the right-hand side of Israel. So just above the whole, Judah's another thing. Judah's a unit on its own. So Benjamin means son of my right hand or son of the south. It's the most southern tribal group in Israel, right on the border of Jerusalem. And then you've got big Judah, which is mainly desert. Of Benjamin, he says, the beloved of Yahweh rests in safety. The high God, surrounds him all day long. The beloved rests between his shoulders. It doesn't mean, I think it basically means here, held here, in the bosom, held here. Like you hold a baby often, held there between the shoulders, and the word for shoulders includes the chest and the upper arm. So it's held there. Back to the psalm. God has promised in his sanctuary, or it may be translated, God is promised by his holiness. It's ambiguous in the Hebrew. In triumph I will divide up Shechem and portion out the valley of Sukkot. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet. I'll come back on this. Judah, my commander's staff. Moab is my washbowl. On Edom I plant my shoe. Against me, Philistia, hurl forth of war cry if you dare. That's Philistines. Who will bring me to the fortified city? Who will lead me to Edom? The fortified city is probably Petra, famous city in the south. Have you not rejected us, O God? O God, you do not go out with our armies. We're losing battles. We should be winning them. Oh, grant us help against the foe, for human help is of no avail. With God we shall do valiantly. It is he who will tread down our foes. And now a map. I'll read the psalm again to you while you watch the map. In triumph I will divide Shechem. Shechem is Nablus pretty well, you know, the Mount Gerizim, it's the capital, well, it was the ancient capital, one of the ancient capitals of Israel, before they built Samaria. So that's Shechem. Portion out the valley of Sukkot. The valley of Sukkot is here, where the river Yabok and the river Jordan meet. Gilead is mine. So that's the Transjordan area, lovely area. That's Gilead, is mine. Manasseh is mine. I haven't put Manasseh. Yes, I have. Manasseh covers both sides. And Gilead is actually almost a subdivision. It depends on whether you... Manasseh is the name of a tribe. Gilead is the name of a geographical area. And some of it is. Manasseh is... Ephraim, that's the big mountainous area of Samaria, basically the whole of Samaria. Manasseh and Ephraim are the sons of Joseph in the kind of legendary history, and they take up the whole of the mountain area of Samaria. So Manasseh is mine. Ephraim is my helmet. Judah, my commander's staff, because it's obviously written by a Jew, and they're the leading tribe at the time. Moab is mine, is my wash bowl, wash basin. Not a very nice thing. The wash basin, there are other words for it. In fact, our pipes here were leaking last week and there was rather an unpleasant smell coming up from the... I don't know what you'd call it. There's a spelling S-H-I-T, but it's not a word you'd use on recording. But whatever, there's probably a nicer word for it, is it?
Sewerage.
Oh, sewerage, thank you. That's lovely. My education was fairly brutal. So the sewerage, yes. Well, Moab means that's where we... Yeah, right, that'll do. Edom, I plant my shoe, because it's at the bottom, you see? Edom, here. That's where I plant my shoe. But then he talks about the capital, Petra, here. They haven't got that far yet, and they're obviously losing some kind of a battle there.